Welcome to Worlds Apart. Over the last several decades, the American foreign policy community has become enamored with the carrot and stick approach, seeming to believe that positive and negative reinforcements, when applied methodically, can reliably produce outcomes preferred by the self-appointed tamer. But given that even donkeys don't respond consistently to this behaviorist training, is it effective against entire nations? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by John Kavulich, president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council. Mr. Kavulich, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Now, my primary interest in this interview is the American and more broadly Western sanctions against Russia, and some would say indirectly against the rest of the world as well. But let's start with a more contained case of the decades-long American efforts to economically penalize Cuba, which I'm sure you are familiar through your line of work very well. Has it been effective?
The challenge with determining effectiveness with respect to U.S. sanctions toward Cuba, commercial, economic, and political, is defining the term. Because when it originated, the goal was regime change. And then you get to, what is that defined as? Does that mean change the people in the regime or change the behavior of the people in the regime? And so over the last 60 years, the U.S. has continued to expand the commercial and the economic and the political perspective with respect to changing the behavior of Cuba. Has it worked? The Cuban government remains, quote, communist, unquote. The Cuban government has not made the type of changes the United States has wanted to make. Primarily why? Well, they've been able to suffer. And I'll give you a quote. A U.S. diplomat in the mid-1990s said to me during a visit, and this was when we had the U.S. interest section. It was during the time where official diplomatic relations were suspended. And he said, to understand Cuba, you have to understand Fidel Castro saying this to the United States. And he said, Fidel Castro would say, I'm willing to let my people suffer. Are you willing to let my people suffer?
Well, this is actually a good question. Are the American officials willing to let their people suffer? Because I heard you say in a couple of interviews that these sanctions hurt not only the Cuban side, but even more so the American side. So what's been the gain for the United States from this policy against Cuba as well as against other countries? And by the United States, I mean the American people, the American taxpayers, and not some highbrow American officials.
You know, how you define success is basically in four-year cycles, the term of the president of the United States. And so what you have is continuing every 4 years, you redefine what you're doing to Cuba, and then you redefine how you're going to define success. For the Cuban people, they've suffered mightily during the last 60 years. Now, have they suffered solely because of U.S. policies, regulations, and laws? No. They've suffered also because of decisions by the Cuban government, which inherently minimize their ability to earn foreign exchange. Has U.S. policy dissuaded the interest of U.S. companies and U.S. individuals toward engagement with Cuba? It has to some extent, particularly companies, because the nature of U.S. sanctions on Cuba, which extend to the Russian Federation in current time, and extend to other countries, China and Syria and North Korea and Venezuela and Nicaragua, et cetera, is what's called exterritoriality. And that means that the U.S. government takes the position that when it implements a sanction on Cuba, that sanction is good anywhere in the world. And so any other company that engages with Cuba, any government that engages with Cuba, they potentially can run afoul of these Treasury departments called OFAC sanctions. And the amount of fines are tremendous.
In Russia, we refer to it as the God complex, the American God complex. But you mentioned before, and there is nothing funny about it, because it's actually calculated in numerous debt, like millions of debts, if you actually take the cumulative effect of it. You know, like I once made a story from Iran about children dying from cancer because they cannot get life-saving drugs. And one would wonder, what do their lives have to do with, you know, the actions of their government that they are not even conscious enough to understand. But speaking of that, do you think that link between economic sanctions, economic limitations, and regime change aspiration, was it only about Cuba, or is it the general feature of the American sanctions regime?
It is, you know, generally the goal of U.S. sanctions to change the behavior of either an entire government or individuals within a government. And that's why you see U.S. sanctions, whether from the Treasury Department, the State Department, or the Commerce Department, will be, you know, sometimes they will say, we're sanctioning these people, and we're not going to let them come to the United States, which generally isn't a great deterrent, because most of these people don't come to the United States. Most of them don't have bank accounts in the United States. So, you know, it becomes more of a political posturing than it does having real teeth and real meaning. If I can circle back one moment to what you said about Iran, because it is valid with Cuba. Every year, the Cubans go to the United Nations and they introduce a resolution condemning U.S. policy. And generally, it is approved overwhelmingly. Usually, it's the United States, Israel, and one or two other countries that vote against it. But the Cubans do have a point in terms of when they say that even though U.S. law, so this isn't U.S. regulations, this isn't the president saying, oh, yes, go ahead and do it. It's not a policy that can be changed. It's by law from 1992, the Cuban Democracy Act, that says you can export healthcare products to Cuba. But because of the odorousness, because of the challenges in terms of getting a license, because of the politics, there are always going to be members of Congress and others that are going to criticize. Even though companies can export healthcare products to Cuba, a lot of them just don't.
Now, one of the things I often hear these days from my non-Western guests, you know, people from Asia, from Africa, is the frustration that they are being drawn into, you know, this conflict that Russia has with the West, or that they are being forced to bear the consequences of this conflict in terms of their economic activity, despite their will. And I wonder, do you think the United States should give any thought to that? I mean, does it hurt the United States that the other countries, big and small, perhaps not as powerful as Russia, still develop resentment against its policies? Because, you know, it is one thing to have some beef with Russia, but it's quite another when, because of that, some African country cannot fulfill its budget or cannot feed its people.
You're absolutely right in terms of the U.S. is putting countries, particularly on the African continent, less into Southeast Asia, in the position of you're with us or you're against us. And, you know, that goes to just a much bigger and fundamental issue that we're having now in the United States.
Mr. Kamalovich, if just for a moment, I think the choice is even more stark. It's to live or to die, because for some of these people, this is not a laughing matter. For them, providing food for their people is a big challenge. So when they are put in that position, it's not just about policy. It's literally about human lives.
You are correct. I'm not making light of that. My point is that for these countries, and I've traveled throughout the African continent and for decades, so I know from what I say, I've seen it, they are being put in a difficult position. And you're right in terms of the commentary by politicians will always be, this isn't against the people. And you can't separate the two. It is impossible. And so for the United States, for the European Union, specifically with respect to what's happening between Russia and Ukraine now. They are being put in a difficult position. South Africa, you know, most recently, where you have the foreign minister Lavrov there. You have war games going on. You have South Africa needing to feed its people. They have all kinds of internal political problems. And then you throw that onto them. Oh, by the way, we're now going to make it more difficult and more expensive for you to get food for your people. So, the consequences are global with respect to trying to change behavior. And you can't separate the two from harming people and trying to change your government's policy.
Now, as we know from physics, any action produces a reaction. And as you noted in one of your articles, the Western-led sanctions have spawned a global sanctions resisting industry. And it was in place before the war in Ukraine, but I think after the conflict began, the kinetic stage of the conflict began, the scale and the visibility of a sanction evasion has become far more prominent. Do you take that as something situational, or do you think it may have a broader structural impact on the global economy?
A broader structural impact, no question. Cuba was sort of the poster child of sanctions. And over 60 years, they have figured out ways to mitigate them. Not completely, but they've figured out ways to mitigate them. And then you move forward with Venezuela and Nicaragua and North Korea and Syria and Iran and the Russian Federation and China. So over the last decade, but absolutely during the last year, it's gone on steroids, because these countries, they get together and they basically say, how do we mitigate primarily what the United States has done? And they've been able to do it. I mean, they've developed basically a PowerPoint presentation or a book, a volume of how do you avoid sanctions? How do you get by with sanctions? And so for the United States, the question is becoming, how effective is it? And unless you have global buy-in, they generally aren't. And we're seeing that with respect to the Russian Federation and China specifically, where they've been successfully able to get around and lessen the impact. There's still impact, but lessen the impact. And then we get to the bigger, bigger question with sanctions, which is, how good are sanctions when those imposing the sanctions are supporting both sides of a conflict?
Well, Mr. Kavulic, it's a deep ethical question. Let's consider it after a short break. Stay tuned.
Museums are important for preserving our history so that it isn't lost to future generations. But are physical museum spaces themselves a relic of the past? This is one of the best museums in the world, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. Mikhail Petrovsky is the director here, and I bet he has some answers.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with John Kavulic, president of the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council. Mr. Kavulic, before the break, we were talking about various ways of circumventing Western sanctions, and I want to share my own experience here because I think it's rather counterintuitive. My kid loves Coca-Cola a lot, and it's not being produced in Russia these days, but a couple of weeks ago, I was able to go to Iran for work matters, and surprise, surprise, I was able to bring him a couple of cans from there. So what do you think about a Russian smuggling the trademark American drink from Iran? Isn't it ironic where we came?
That's a great story. I can give you one with Cuba. Coca-Cola used to be produced in Cuba. And when the Cuban Revolution happened, they expropriated the Coca-Cola plant. Coca-Cola stopped producing. But over the years, Coca-Cola Mexico has exported Coca-Cola products into Cuba. So when you get a Cuba Libre, Coca-Cola rum in Cuba, you're using Coca-Cola that is made in Mexico, that is owned by Coca-Cola in Atlanta, Georgia. So it is amazing how products flow, and they generally, you know, it's like water. If you get a leak in your house, water, you would think the water is going to go in one direction, but it doesn't. It goes in all different directions. And that's the same with avoiding sanctions. There are always ways to do it because it's a business. People are always going to want to make money from it. And people are always going to want to find the products that they want.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know for a fact that the Russians are now very deliberate in studying both the Iranian and Cuban experience of circumventing sanctions and growing their own domestic industry instead. I wonder if you think that's also worthwhile for other countries, not necessarily American adversaries, given your understanding of where the global economy is heading. What do you think is a safer bet, to sort of rely on the global production chains or to invest in your own self-sufficiency in this regard?
COVID, beginning in 2020, changed the dynamic with respect to how countries looked at what had been, you know, the big word was outsourcing, you know, during the last 5 years. It was, you know, don't do it yourselves, send it to a country that has lower costs, have them do it, and then import it back. And so that's what everyone was doing. But what did COVID do? It disrupted supply chains. And so factories were shut down, shipping companies weren't operating. And then when they were, shipping prices were going, you know, fivefold in terms of cost. So from 2021, 2022, governments, those that are under sanction and those that are not, started saying, wow, we need to now look at insourcing. So let's try to bring all this production back just in case there's another pandemic, or with respect to Russia and Ukraine, there's a war, there's a conflict, there's a special military, whatever you want to call it, but there's an interruption that becomes global. And for the US, Taiwan is a great example of this because the US has been a protector of Taiwan. The consensus is that President Xi, during probably the next 5 years, is going to absorb Taiwan peacefully, by force, by both, whatever. But one of the reasons that Taiwan is important is because chips, computer chips. And so what has the United States been doing last year and this year? And President Biden has been traveling around saying, we're investing all this money to bring chip manufacturing back to the United States. Well, part of the result of that is you weaken Taiwan in terms of its ability to have people supporting its independence. The same goes with respect to other countries, and they become very adept at replacing.
Let me ask you specifically about the American intention, desire to penalize Russia, because with all due respect to Iran, Nicaragua, and Cuba, you know, that animosity with the United States has this, you know, David versus Goliath dynamic. You know, one country is much bigger than the other, but Russia is a fairly big market, not as big, of course, as the American one, but a fairly big. But what's more important, I think, territorially, it's a huge country with access to abundant mineral resources, vital waterways. So I wonder if you think the American intention to, cordon off or ostracize Russia, is it realistic at all, given simply Russia's size and its integration into the global economy? And given that, unlike in the Cold War, Russia doesn't want to be isolated from the rest of the world.
From a business perspective, there are 145 million consumers in the Russian Federation. So, you know, no company is going to want to write that off. And even since February 24th of last year, the number of companies that have remained in the Russian Federation are much higher than people think for various reasons, whether it's, you know, legal or it's positional, but they've remained. And, you know, the U.S. government's goal with respect to changing the behavior of the Russian Federation when it comes to Ukraine, it's difficult to separate that from the impact of sanctions and with respect to access to the marketplace. Because for U.S. companies, even today, and this goes sort of circle to what I was saying before about both sides supporting both sides, is that the sanctions from the United States, from the European Union, other countries today exempt certain products from sanctions, including products that are transported from China across Russia into the European Union. And why is that? Because Russia is deemed an important source of those products. They don't want market disruption. At the same time, those same countries that are importing some of those products from the Russian Federation are also supporting Ukraine. So until those that are supporting both sides make a decision in terms of lessening that support, ending that support, we have an economic conflict that's going to continue. But in terms of, you know, just the marketplace, you know, every company that I've talked to, you know, they want to return to the Russian Federation marketplace.
Now, I want to seize upon something that you said a moment ago, that while trying to change Russia's behavior, certain countries are not trying to change their own behavior and continue sort of penalizing Russia while also buying products from it, while also sending weapons to Ukraine and perhaps also making some profit from that. Are you sure that those countries that proclaim the hard support for Ukraine actually want to see an end to this war?
War is incredibly profitable. And the war between Russia and Ukraine will continue until it's not profitable. Wars become profitable for defense industries. They become profitable for financial institutions. They become profitable for politicians who end up running on war more tough than the person we're running against. And you get this battle of testosterone. You know, who's going to be more muscular? And we've had that with Cuba. It's, you know, you'll hear politicians, if I'm elected, I'll sanction Cuba. If I'm elected, I'll invade Cuba. If I'm elected, I'll send nuclear weapons and blow up Cuba. If, you know, and it gets absurd. In the case of the Russian Federation and Ukraine, you do have you know, a conflict that is becoming profitable. Or I'm sorry, it has become profitable. And as more it continues, it's going to become more profitable. And then it becomes more difficult to stop.
Mm-hmm. Now, can I ask you about something? Because I know that recently you visited both Russia and Ukraine, and I appreciate your desire and efforts to actually learn about the situation on the ground. But I was struck by your account of a conversation that you had with some Ukrainian young men in Kyiv, during which they ask you, why don't Russian people take to the social media and tell the Putin government that war is horrible? And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your response was something along the lines that, you know, the Russian understanding of freedom is somewhat different, blah, blah, blah. And with all my respect to you, I find this extremely condescending, because I don't know a single person in Russia who believes that this war is a marvelous option. I think a lot of people believe that this is the horrible option, but the policy of the United States, divide and conquer policy of the United States, left us with no other choice. And I was wondering whether it would perhaps have been more honest to tell those free Ukrainian young people to tell their own government to stop
turning that country into a, you know, battering ram against Russia, and to stop, you know, getting all the advice, all the weapons from the United States or from the West, and perhaps mind their own interests, because in this case, Russia and Ukraine can find a mutually respectful and profitable way of coexisting. What do you think about that?
Well, thank you for your comment. I would suggest that there's a little distance between how you described what I said to those young people. And I said that there are different government structures and different social structures. And so it's you can't simply say that why young people are behaving one way in Ukraine and not in the Russian Federation and use the same metrics, just measure it. So I said that they were different. It was just a different environment, even though the beliefs may be the same, how they manifest them are different. And that's not a criticism. That's just looking at the reality of different structures. You know, you make a point, and it's valid, absolutely, in terms of how people are looking at the conflict from different perspectives, not just in the Russian Federation and Ukraine, but from outside. And it's very difficult. You know, I have the luxury of being able to go in and go out. But there are people who are in the Russian Federation and the Ukraine, who don't have that luxury. So they don't have the ability to distance themselves from what they're seeing, what they're feeling, the impacts. They have to live it every day. You have to live it every day. And it's all about degrees, and it's all about, you know, level of impact. But it does impact everyone in different ways, and they manifest, you know, those beliefs in different ways. I think
I'm sorry for interrupting, because we are running out of time quickly. But one of the hopeful messages in your writing was that, and you looked at the various histories of antagonism between countries. You mentioned that if we actually look at the economic history, starting from the World War One all the way to the Vietnam War, there were many examples of former antagonists becoming economic partners. Do you think that's still possible for Ukraine and Russia to not be friends, not be brothers? I think that's something that we no longer hope for, but coexisting in a mutually respectful manner, when we can stop being enemies for one another, deliberate enemies for one another.
Yes. You know, Ukraine and Russia share I believe it's about a 1,300-mile border. We're drawing certain areas, but you're next to one another. And there is a history with respect to the people. Roughly 44 million people in Ukraine, roughly 144 or more people in the Russian Federation. So when this conflict ends, and it will end, it must end, and the definition of end is going to be subject to negotiation and semantics and that, but there will be, again, commercial relationships, there'll be social relationships, there'll be family relationships. It's going to take some time, but it's natural. And, you know, there isn't going to be a great wall built between Ukraine and the Russian Federation. You know, we're not going to get Chinese architects to come and build a Great Wall, or
hopefully
President
we
Trump
also will not have the American architects to come in and insist on that. But hearing that from an American like yourself is I wouldn't say it's very encouraging, but it does produce some hope in me. Mr. Kovalich, we have to leave it there, but I really, really appreciate your time and your candor today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.